In the case of the Taliban in Afghanistan, maybe it's time for a new strategy. As General Stanley McChrystal, the commander in Afghanistan, issues a report on the war, the White House lowers the boom, or is it the bar?
He says the situation is quite serious, but the war is indeed winnable.
Robert Gibbs says it's down to winnable. Winnable in our time? That's a whole other question on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI.
If you can't beat them, join them. Good morning. It's Tuesday, September 1st. I'm John Huckenberry, joined with Celeste Headlee all week long. Good morning, Celeste.
Good morning, John. Coming up this hour, it's Pinocchio versus the Hulk. Then we'll run through the contenders for the late Ted Kennedy's Senate seat. And 4 years after Katrina, New Orleans residents still waiting for a new hospital.
But first, Fotini Christia, assistant professor in political science at MIT, has just returned from Afghanistan. Professor Christia, we sort of half-seriously referred to, if you can't beat him, join him, at the top of the hour there. Is there a way, in your view, to make a deal with the Taliban without losing all political conscience?
We can't have it any other way. While sending more troops is definitely necessary to tip the balance of power against the insurgency, and we're expecting General McChrystal to request more troops, it will only work if it's accompanied by some sort of effort to persuade Taliban fighters to give up the fight by drawing a distinction between good Taliban and bad Taliban.
All right.
That said, reconciliation is only going to be part of a larger military and political strategy.
Well, we want to explore the devilish details in dealing with the Taliban. Fotini Christia, stay with us. But first, everything you need to know this morning. Celeste?
In the headlines, in Southern California, dozens of homes have burned to the ground. Thousands more are threatened by deadly L.A. County fires. More evacuations have been ordered. Here's local resident Sylvia Avanisian.
Definitely frightening. We've never seen the fire so close. I mean, you can even feel the heat right next to you when we're just like down the street.
The flames are just 15 miles north of downtown L.A. Hurricane Ximena is almost a Category 5 storm. It could hit Mexico's Baja California Peninsula tonight. Emergency workers are evacuating thousands of people from there.
It's biblical down there in California. Back in the U.S., the president starts September with a briefing on the latest preparations for H1N1 or swine flu. He'll hear from the CDC and Homeland Security. Massachusetts lawmakers might honor the late Ted Kennedy's request to fill his Senate seat fast. They'll take up a bill next week that would let the state's Democratic governor appoint an interim successor in the Senate until a special election is held in January. Markets were slightly down yesterday. The Dow opens today at 94.96. The S&P starts trading at 10.21. And the NASDAQ begins at 20.09. Futures trading suggests a negative opening when Wall Street gets going in about an hour and a half from now. In the middle of the health care debate, we've heard a lot of people who didn't like their health insurance, who weren't happy about it at all. But if you're happy with your own health care insurance, what's great about it? We want to hear your story at 877-8-MY-TAKE. What your insurance does for you.
My name's Tom. I'm from West Falmouth, and I think the health care that we have is really good. The insurance that we have is adequate, and I think the real key is to stay fit and make sure you get plenty of sleep and have a good diet.
Apparently, 70% of Americans think like Tom does there. Tell us your story at 877-8-MY-TAKE or send us an email to mytake@takeaway.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway.
I'm Celeste Headlee. A U.S. service member has been killed in Afghanistan. NATO says the death today followed a bomb attack in southern Afghanistan on Monday, and August was the deadliest month for foreign troops in Afghanistan during this war. So on top of that, we have this report from General Stanley McChrystal. He's America's top commander in Afghanistan. And the full text of the report has not been made public, but we did get a look at the general's assessment of the situation there, and that says that the current strategy in Afghanistan is not working. Here's Press Secretary Robert Gibbs speaking on Monday in Washington.
Based on some initial reporting that I've seen of General McChrystal's report, he says the situation is quite serious, but the war is indeed winnable.
Colonel Richard Kemp was leading the UK forces in Afghanistan back in 2003. He also served time in Bosnia and in Iraq, and he's written a book, Attack State Red. It's going to be published in the UK this week. Colonel, good morning.
Good morning to you.
So from what you've heard of the report from General Stanley McChrystal, do you agree with some of his things? Is the strategy in Afghanistan not working?
Yes, I think he's probably right about that. I think it's not so much, as far as I see it, it's not so much the strategy itself that's not working. I think it's not that it's in need of a new strategy. I think that it's in need of more emphasis on those elements of the strategy he has focused on, and in particular, more resources going into protecting the local population.
So more troops.
Which means more troops, yes, indeed, and also in building up the Afghan National Army more rapidly and in greater numbers. And again, that needs more troops to do it.
But, you know, the problem with building up local forces in Afghanistan has been hampered by corruption. It's been hampered by a bureaucracy, by local tribal leaders who get in the way. How is he going to do that?
Well, I think the building up of the Afghan National Army has been quite successful recently, and the many units of the Afghan National Army are very effective, and you know they work very well. They're very professional, and so there obviously that there is a variable standards throughout the country, but on the whole, it's gone well. I think it needs to have even more emphasis put on it, but it has been okay. Corruption is one of the biggest problems, of course, and I think you'll find if you talk to most Afghans on the ground today, their biggest concern is the level of corruption in the government, which they were promised so much and have seen so little from the government in Kabul.
Have you seen other parts of the report? What other details are in there?
Well, my understanding of it is that there's a greater call for more emphasis on reconstruction to make life for the Afghans better. And I think, again, that needs all of these things need a lot of resource and perhaps even more or as much as that. They need willpower to drive them forward. But reconstruction projects in Afghanistan, particularly in the south, in the Helmand area, where the British have been operating for some time and where the U.S. Marines are now operating there in far greater strength, the level of reconstruction effort there has been almost embarrassing, and British forces and now US forces have taken large swathes of country and occupied areas and put troops into areas, but they have not so far seen a significant reconstruction effort coming in to back that up. So that's very important. The second other area that I've seen emphasized is the need to split away those elements of the Taliban that can be split away, and he's talking about maybe solving 60% of the problem by giving out jobs to some of the people who are currently fighting us. I think that's also highly possible. I don't know if 60% is the right figure. I guess he probably knows what he's talking about there. But it's certainly an area to be focused on. And what we're talking about really, again, is more money. We're talking about outbidding the Taliban for the actions of many members of the civilian population.
You just marked in the UK a sort of tragic landmark where you hit your 200th death among your servicemen from Britain. And I'm wondering, is there still an appetite among NATO members to send more troops, to send more resources to this region?
Well, among NATO members, I think we've had problems for a long time. Britain has been the second largest troop contributor next to the United States. Canada has been a substantial contributor. There have been one or two other countries like Holland who have also contributed a fair amount. But we haven't seen the level of effort from NATO that we really need to have. And that needs to be, although that needs to be worked on, I'm personally not confident we're going to see much more in the way of NATO fighting forces there. In Britain, we have, it's true, seen a wavering of public opinion in the face of a stream of body bags coming back from Afghanistan without much explanation by the government on what it's all about and what it's for. At least the explanations have been slightly confused and not clear and probably not persuasive.
Well, and indeed, Richard Kemp, it's been the deadliest month for U.S. forces here in August, followed by the second deadliest month, which was July. You're talking about a fairly complicated, multi-layered level of reconstruction in Afghanistan, which would involve, as you mentioned, outbidding the Taliban. Rejoining our conversation now, Fotini Christia, assistant professor of political science at MIT, joins us once again from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Richard Kemp there, who formerly commanded UK forces in Afghanistan, suggests that part of the mission has to be outbidding the Taliban, but you might take it even further. Actually making deals with the Taliban are the only real way of holding territory and maintaining a form of civil security in Afghanistan, correct?
Yes, that's absolutely right. I mean, the idea is that we have to squeeze them first before we flip them. So there's definitely a need for an increased military presence. But after that, we definitely need to be making the right offers to get them to switch to our side. My concern is that so far we've concentrated our efforts to clearing the area, but not really to holding and building. Therefore, we don't really have a plan on how to reconcile with the Taliban. So it's good to see that that's part of the new strategy proposed by General McChrystal.
But how politically sensitive is it for, say, the Obama administration to basically say to the American people, you know, these Taliban that we've been saying are, you know, essentially the great Satan for the last 8 years, all of a sudden we're going to be making a deal with them. They're our allies in Afghanistan. Is that going to fly?
Yeah, it's actually really interesting because it's actually a very acceptable thing amongst Afghans. If you talk to ordinary Afghan citizens, they expect that a deal needs to be struck with the Taliban. They see a Taliban as part of the Afghan culture and society. They don't see it winning any. They don't see us winning the war in any other way other than by striking a deal. So public opinion polls in Afghanistan show an increased desire for reconciliation talks and actually even for power sharing.
And we should remind people that this is information that you've just received, just returning from Afghanistan. You also had a piece this summer in Foreign Policy magazine where you describe in quite detail how province by province, flipping the Taliban is a practical way of achieving some sort of rapprochement in Afghanistan, right?
Absolutely. In that piece we're describing with an individual, Michael Semple, has spent a lot of time working on the issue of reconciliation with the Taliban, how that could be done. The idea is that you can't pursue this dialogue on the very high echelons of the Taliban because then it will be hijacked by the real kind of fanatics within the movement. At the same time, you can't expect to do it on the level of the individual foot soldier.
Well, let's talk to a foot soldier for a second. Richard Kemp, former commander of UK forces in Afghanistan, is it practical to flip the Taliban, as Fotini Christia is suggesting up there at MIT?
I think it's not just practical. I think it's vital that we do that. Now, my view is we can't go to the top level of the Taliban, Mullah Omar and his sort of echelons, sort of immediately below that. We can't do that, partly because they are implacably opposed to what we want to achieve, and I don't see any way in which they will ever be reconciled to anything like the objectives we've got. And also, they have no desire to talk to us. It's quite clear that they think they're in the ascendancy. They think they've got the upper hand. And why would they talk to us? They wouldn't. I think below that, there are elements of the Taliban that we should and could be talking to. We can win over in one way or the other. But I think that we've got to do this from a position of strength. So what we've got to do is continue to cause attrition to the Taliban and continue to write them down and undermine their insurgency so that we're speaking to them and negotiating with them from a position of significant power.
So probably your takeaway from this is, from what I'm hearing you, is outbid the Taliban and work with them.
Well, I think we do two things. Three things in effect. We first of all have to cause attrition to the Taliban, to undermine the insurgency by killing them in fairly large numbers because they're trying to kill us and they're trying to kill the people in Afghanistan. Secondly, those elements that we can win on to our side, we should work on that and try and undermine the insurgency in that way. And thirdly, at the same time, building up the Afghan National Security Forces so that they can take on the continued management of the insurgency at a lower level than it is now. I don't think we're ever going to eradicate or eliminate this insurgency, but I think we can bring it to a manageable level the Afghans can take over.
Great thoughts. Richard Kemp, former commander of UK forces in Afghanistan, author of the book Attack State Red, published in the UK, this week. And Fotini Christou, you want to take us out with a final thought in the last 15 seconds?
Yeah, all I want to say that it's critical to make reconciliation a huge part of the effort to resolve the war, but we have to keep in mind that it's not the only thing, it's only part of the strategy. So we need other components. We need to be building local governance. It's not just the army and the police, it's also district-level governance.
Kind of a political surge needed at all levels there. That's our takeaway from Fotini Christia, just returned from Afghanistan. She's assistant professor of political science at MIT and spoke to us from Cambridge, Massachusetts.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
You're listening to The Takeaway. from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. John Hockenberry here with Celeste Headlee. And you know, I guess if you are as big as Disney, well...
I got nothing. No, Mr.
Well, we believe in the value of the Marvel brand, and we intend fully to not only use the Marvel brand, but to use our distribution and our marketing platforms globally to help grow that brand.
That's Disney CEO Bob Iger announcing his company's $4 billion acquisition of Marvel, Inc. That's the comics house become laboratory of superhero drama and angst.
I mean, basically, the mouse gets the Iron Man. Pinocchio gets the Hulk. 5,000 characters now go to live in the magic kingdom of Sleeping Beauties and Snow White's. That's a serious case of multiple personalities.
I've got a problem. There are aspects of my personality that I can't control.
See a shrink.
It's a little bit more complicated than that.
Spider-Man, Spider-Man.
But will Spidey find a home in the rafters of the Seven Dwarves cottage? Does Disney take the edge off of Iron Man?
Well, yesterday, speaking to stockholders and other investors, CEO Bob Iger couldn't have sounded happier in a creepy sort of way.
This is a great fit for us because we'd love to attract more boys, and we think clearly that Marvel's skew is more in the boys' direction, although there's a universal appeal, we think, to a lot of their characters and a lot of their stories.
That went well. What do you think the over-under on the stock drop is going to be tomorrow?
Optimistically, 40 points.
At minimum.
Whatever the Disney stock price does, you have to admit, the possibilities are endless. Mulan and Daredevil.
You've got Captain America and Nemo.
Minnie Mouse and the Hulk.
That's weird.
The mind goes wild.
Uncle Scar, when I'm king... what'll that make you?
Your friendly neighborhood Spider-Man.
Come on, little fella. Come on.
Dory, I'm a little fella. I don't think that's a little fella.
Hulk smash!
We know who we are. Ask her who she is and what she's doing here.
Yeah. What are you and who are you doing? What are you? Who are you, my dear?
I'm Charles Xavier. Would you like some breakfast?
Yes. My breakfast. You may serve.
So we welcome now Mary Elizabeth Wilkinson.
I'm daydreaming in that montage of Disney and Marvel. There.
I imagine a lot of people are. Yeah. Mary Elizabeth Williams is the culture critic for Salon.com. Mary, what does all this mean?
Good morning. I love that mashup. And like Disney, I too would like to attract more boys. I guess I just need $4 billion to do it.
$4 billion?
That's pretty attractive, right? Yeah, who knew there was $4 billion to be thrown around in this country at
this Marvel
time?
See this coming?
Well, that's kind of, I mean, we didn't. That was the big surprise yesterday. But, you know, this is their first year in a few that they haven't had a big blockbuster. They released their quarterlies earlier in August, and their net profits were down.
Wow.
But that's to be expected because they didn't have an Iron Man this year. They didn't have a Spider-Man this year. But, you know, $4 billion, it sounds like a lot of money when you say it off the top of your head. But, you know, 3 years ago, Disney paid almost double that to get Pixar. So if we give it a little bit of historical perspective, it's actually kind of a bargain basement price.
And what they get is amazing. I mean, listen to these characters. Ajax, Ajaxus, Albion, All America, Alpha Flight, American
Wait,
Eagle.
Wait, there's 5,000, John.
5,000.
We could be here all day.
There's like 7 Captain Americas.
There's 7. They get 5,000 characters. They get the
5,000 brands.
They get 5,000 brands. And as we heard Robert Iger saying, they are much more boy friendly. And when we think of Disney, particularly in the last generation or so, what do we think of? We think of princesses.
Ariel.
And is going to change that.
But they've bought a lot of animated characters. I mean, I was surprised to learn about a decade ago that Disney bought Winnie the Pooh.
Very different. Yeah. And they don't have Christopher Robin anymore. Christopher Robin is a girl under the Disney umbrella, which is not an accident.
So
but people who are concerned about what's going to happen to these edgy characters, is Spider-Man going to lose his dark side?
That's
you know, we
right.
need to if we keep it in any kind of perspective. Remember, Disney ran Miramax for 13 years. Disney ran Dimension Films.
Touchstone.
Right. They still have touch tone. So when we, you know, we think about, is this a studio that is willing to put a pickaxe in a teenage girl's throat? The answer is yes, they are, well, if that's what it takes.
But it's also about global branding in the sense that these characters are not tied to the English language. They can move into any market in any language.
Absolutely. When I worked for Sony Pictures, I still remember that was what they said. It's like, get the movies that translate. Get the get your action heroes. And that's what's going to happen. We're not going to really see this happening, though, for a couple of years. Paramount still owns Iron Man. They own the next two Iron Man movies. Sony owns some of the of these brands. So it's going to take a couple of years before we really see the rollout. But yes, they've now been assimilated into the Disney Borg, and we're going to start seeing those figures
Disney Borg.
As a theme park.
Can't Disney make it very difficult for Paramount to finish these films?
Well, they have said that they are going to honor it in a gentleman's way. But, we'll see what happens after the next movie. And who's got more money than Disney? Apparently the answer is no, not America, not anybody else.
Dr. Druid film.
Exactly.
That's
right.
Digitech.
You want to know where the money is? It's in comic book characters. That's the global economy now in comic book characters.
A takeaway from Mary Elizabeth Williams. Thanks so much for coming. She's our friend and contributor, also the culture critic for Salon.com. We're now going to take a look at some of the top news stories.
Well, wildfires continue to rage north of downtown Los Angeles today. The fire has already consumed at least 53 homes and is threatening thousands more. The blaze is also threatening Mount Wilson, which is home to at least 20 television transmission towers, radio and cell phone antenna, and a century-old observatory. You could see the wildfire photographs from KPCC, the public radio station in Southern California, online. Just go to thetakeaway.org. President Obama is starting the month of September with a briefing on the latest efforts to prepare for the H1N1 virus, also known as swine flu. Senior officials will outline government efforts to respond to the virus. And later today, the president will host a dinner to celebrate the Muslim holy month of Ramadan.
President Obama told Congress he's reducing pay increases for federal workers next year. Increases will be 2% instead of 2.4%. The president says national unemployment and the size of the federal payroll make the reduction necessary. Former Presidents George Bush and Bill Clinton also changed federal salaries. World leaders meet in Poland today to commemorate the 70th anniversary of the start of World War II. Ceremonies began at dawn at the spot where a German battleship fired the first shots of the war in 1939.
The federal government will pay about $9.5 million for land that will be site for the Flight 93 National Memorial. The flight, which crashed in rural southwestern Pennsylvania on September 11, 2001, killed 33 passengers and 7 crew members. Construction on the memorial is expected to start in November. The goal is to complete it by the 10th anniversary of the terrorist attacks 2 years from now. And those are some of the top stories we're watching today.
So in Massachusetts, they're now going to hold a special election to replace Ted Kennedy, and the results could affect the healthcare debate pretty significantly for the entire nation. That's coming up in just a few minutes.
You're listening to The Takeaway.
It's The Takeaway. I'm Celeste Headlee. So yesterday, Massachusetts Governor Deval Patrick said the state will hold a special election to determine who takes Ted Kennedy's seat in the Senate.
Today, in accordance with my responsibility under Massachusetts law, I am designating Tuesday, January 19, 2010, as the date of the special election. Massachusetts voters will have their opportunity to fill this Senate vacancy.
So there's going to be a special election in January, but in the meantime, the Massachusetts legislators say they're going to hold a public hearing next week to discuss changing the state law so that they can get someone to fill Kennedy's seat in the interim. Governor Patrick said he's going to work with the legislature on that. And for those who are keeping a close eye on who might replace Ted Kennedy, Governor Patrick had one very interesting bit of news to announce. He spoke with Kennedy's wife, Vicky.
Mrs. Kennedy is not interested in the position.
Frank Phillips is with us. He's the State House Bureau Chief for the Boston Globe. Frank, the governor said in no uncertain terms Vicky Kennedy is out of the running for the seat. So who's left? Who's going to be taking the seat?
Let me clarify that. The question was that she was not interested in the interim seat. So I want to make that clear that the senator
Frank's
would
always... very sharp. That Frank, nothing goes past Frank Phillips. No way.
I'm in the weeds on this thing, let me tell you.
So you're saying she might be interested in the special election, but not in this seat that where she'd only be there for a number of months?
We don't know about the election. He was specifically asked about the interim, and he said, that's all I know is that she's not interested in the interim appointment. All indications from the family is that she's not in the general election, in the special election. Yeah.
So who is? Who's interested in the interim position?
Well, what makes us believe that she's not interested is a former representative Joseph Kennedy is looking at it. His friends say he's 50-50. He would be the only viable candidate to get into this race. He's been there before. He's been to Washington. He's got experience in business. He would be, and he knows how to campaign, and people know him, and he would be the candidate to get in this race.
In the race, you're talking about him for the special election.
Special election. Oh, you were asking about the interim?
Who could take the interim position?
Well, that's pure speculation. The governor, in the last few days, I asked him a couple of days ago, and he just said, look, I haven't even thought about that, doesn't want to think about it. All of us are obviously speculating about it. And Michael Dukakis, his name comes up.
Interesting.
He would have the stature, the ability to go down and talk about health care. He campaigned on it in 1988 nationally.
Maybe he'll get into one of these, sort of vortexes of political catastrophe like David Paterson did in New York and see if Caroline Kennedy is interested.
I think we've been there with Caroline, and I don't think they're going to try to ask her to come in. But I mean, anything's in the realm of possibilities here on the interim appointment.
Now, Ted Kennedy specifically asked that they change the law to make it possible that they're going to have an interim, and it seems pretty likely, does it not, that they are going to make the changes, even though they did it the other way around when they had a Republican government?
They're moving there. There is resistance. State legislators, Democrats and Republicans mostly, but Democrats too, feel some anger out there among the voters. They've slashed budgets. They've raised taxes. They know there's volatility out there. They do fear some voter backlash. They could care less about what Obama's interests are, or Harry Reid, or health care reform. They want to get reelected next year, and they don't need another controversy thrown on their plate that is going to draw candidates in races into races against them. So there is resistance there. I think it's breaking down somewhat. The leadership is coming around to it, and I think there'll be a vigorous debate on it. The betting is probably in the end they'll do it, and they'll do it fairly shortly in the next couple of weeks.
Because I assume that the question is, can health care reform wait until the special election in January? Frank Phillips is the bureau chief of the Boston Globe.
Down in the weeds on the Kennedy succession story. That's an interesting one. Joining us now is Louise Story, Wall Street and finance reporter for our partner, the New York Times. The theme this week is housing. Good morning, Louise.
Good morning.
Yesterday we were talking about Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac and the sort of credit crunch of their regulations and how that affects the mortgage market. We're likely to get numbers later this morning on housing sales, which are another indication of demand for housing. What's going on here, and are we seeing some stabilization?
So it looks like for the sixth consecutive month, housing prices are going to go up again for pending house sales. Those are the ones that are under contract. They haven't happened yet. And this is the latest of several housing surveys that we're seeing. We saw one about metropolitan cities last week where 18 out of 20 cities saw their housing prices going up. Now, of course, this is just month over month, so we're still down a lot from a year ago.
And is this generalizable to the broad market for home buyers out there, or is this a very narrow slice of very creditworthy customers, and it might not affect general consumers?
A lot of these surveys are very broad, and so people are seeing this as a real turning point. And I think what you could compare it to is, the housing index is kind of like a bravery index, and people are getting brave again. People are going in. Buyers were afraid to buy because they were afraid they would buy, and then the house they just bought would go down more. And since you see it stabilizing, people are jumping in.
And basically, we're finding that financing is available and that housing prices aren't continuing to slide so that you don't notice a loss the moment after
you buy it. Right. And the mortgage rates are also pretty low still. So, even though prices are going up, we're back at 2003 levels. So, housing is comparatively cheap. Of course, it's relative. You know, in 06, it was kind of foolishly expensive.
Which, sector of the country should we look to when these numbers come out later this morning as a real bellwether for what's going on generally in the country?
Well, so far the Midwest numbers have been good in this particular survey that's coming out today. But as always, we want to look where the problem was the worst. And the worst problem was in the Sun Belt and areas like Las Vegas. And Las Vegas actually really has not turned yet. So if we see any improvement in Las Vegas and Phoenix and Florida and California and the places where the bubble was the steepest, then you might think that this is a good sign.
So New York Times reporter Louise Story's takeaway is so goes Las Vegas, so goes the rest of the housing economy. Watch for those numbers later on this morning. Louise, thanks so much. And now we'll take a look at the top headlines this morning.
The National Hurricane Center forecast for Hurricane Ximena has just been updated. The Pacific storm isn't weakening. It's packing winds near 155 miles an hour, putting it just short of Category 5. It's set to hit Mexico's Baja California area today. Gay marriage became legal in Vermont at midnight Eastern Time. Eager couples held early morning ceremonies today. Vermont is the fifth state with legal same-sex marriage.
In Europe, there's new hope this morning that a century of bitterness could end. Old foes Turkey and Armenia are launching talks that could lead to normal relations. The old enemy's biggest rift is over the Ottoman Empire era massacre of some 1.5 million Armenians early last century. The Armenians call it the genocide. A couple of interesting environmental stories are happening today. UN boss Ban Ki-moon is visiting the Arctic Circle, highlighting climate change issues ahead of a key global meeting. And also today, a European Union ban on incandescent light bulbs. Many styles of them takes effect today. Those are some of the top stories you're watching today.
4 years ago, Hurricane Katrina wiped out New Orleans Charity Hospital. Do they rebuild it or replace it? That's coming up in about 10 minutes. This is The Takeaway. I'm Celeste Headlee.
And I'm John Hockenberry with a little taste of 1939. 70 years ago this week, America was well over the rainbow and in the middle of a dream, humming this pop tune. The Depression was slipping into the past. 70 years ago, it was a crossroads for 20th century history. America had a chance, perhaps the last chance, to take George Washington's old advice and avoid foreign entanglements. It was 70 years ago today, you see, that Germany's armored divisions crossed the border into Poland to begin the Second World War.
Polen hat heute Nacht zum ersten Mal auf unserem eigenen Territorium auch mit bereits regulären Soldaten.
That's the voice of Adolf Hitler 70 years ago, the crazed narrator for a European soundtrack that was equal parts German nationalism and utopian lunacy. The Third Reich would unite the German-speaking peoples in a genetically purified master race to rule over Russia, France, and the British Empire. America could stand aside or be buried by the onslaught of inevitable history. Poor little Poland, a stepping stone for Hitler's panzer units and high-tech blitzkrieg army. But the soundtrack in America had none of the relentless predation of Wagner or the menace of Shostakovich. It was Glenn Miller's Moonlight Serenade, one of the most popular tunes of 1939. Ironically, Miller would lose his life during the war when his plane went down on a trip to perform for U.S. troops. But that was years in the future.
Do I love you? Do I?
This bit of Cole Porter froth was typical of 1939 America. The popular Broadway musical Du Barry Was a Lady. Ethel Merman, Betty Grable, later of serviceman pinup girl fame, and Bert Lahr, the Cowardly Lion. It's about a washroom attendant who wins the lottery and dreams he is Louis XV of France. Meanwhile, Germany invades and occupies France.
I have seen war, and that I hate war. I hope the United States will keep out of this war, and I give you assurance and reassurance that every effort of your government will be directed toward that end.
This was delivered by FDR on September 3rd, 1939. America couldn't have been further from this war in 1939. In fact, historians believe that Britain's Winston Churchill and FDR conspired to bring the United States into World War II, despite considerable pro-German, if not pro-Nazi, sentiment in the U.S. FDR would evoke conscience again and again to inch America closer to the European conflict. And in the end, it wasn't conscience that brought the U.S. into the war, it was provocation. Japan's attack on Pearl Harbor ended America's isolation 2 years later. Never again would we be so disentangled from global affairs. Though our minds might wander, our troops would remain stationed throughout the world, today fighting wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. And I heard of once in a 70 years after the second war to end all wars began.
You're listening to The Takeaway from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
I'm Celeste Headley here with John Hockenberry. Coming up, Hurricane Katrina closed a hospital for New Orleans poor and uninsured. We're going to check in on the efforts to revive it in a few minutes. And for those of you who do have health care coverage and are happy with it, surveys say most of you are, we're asking, what's so great about your insurance plan? Weigh in, because we want to hear what you have to say. 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. But first, let's take a look at today's top news stories. Southern California authorities expect the wildfire raging near Los Angeles to burn for weeks. The six-day-old fire has destroyed more than 50 homes and threatened thousands more. The deadly fire, named the Station Fire because it started near a ranger station in the Angeles National Forest, also threatens Mount Wilson, home to television transmission towers and cell phone antennas. China has canceled or postponed several events meant to highlight its improving relationship with Taiwan. The move by China is seen as a sign of anger towards Taiwan for allowing the Dalai Lama to visit. The Dalai Lama was invited by Taiwan's opposition party to comfort victims of last month's deadly typhoon.
Nearly one-third of all cocaine seized in the United States is apparently laced with a dangerous veterinary drug. That's according to documents from the Drug Enforcement Administration. The medication, which is used to deworm livestock, is believed to have killed at least three people in the U.S. and Canada and sickened more than 100 others. Boxing legend Muhammad Ali is getting in touch with his little-known Irish roots. The three-time world heavyweight champion is visiting the hometown of his great-grandfather in Ireland. Fans in the western Irish town have decorated shops and streets with posters of Muhammad Ali. He'll be honored by the town council while there. Those are some of the top stories we're watching today.
So all this week, we're taking a look at the lasting effects of Hurricane Katrina 4 years after the flood. The storm dealt a devastating blow to Charity Hospital there. The hospital had served many of the city's poor and uninsured residents for about 250 years. The floods forced it to close. So 4 years after Katrina, Charity Hospital is still closed. And a grassroots campaign to reopen the hospital has enlisted one of the Crescent City's most famous doctors.
You don't mean?
Dr. John.
Hey, listen, I everything in my life is connected to Charity Hospital. I was a Charity Hospital baby, but all of us have a deep love for what Charity Hospital stood for, the community. If we can get Charity Hospital open fast and cheap, well, how come we're not doing that? Call Governor Jenner and tell him to reopen Charity Hospital.
If they can get Charity Hospital open fast and cheap, why aren't they doing it? That's a good question. And to answer it, we have Karen DeSalvo. She's the Vice Dean of Community Affairs and Health Policy at Tulane School of Medicine. Also to talk with us about alternatives in New Orleans is Clinical Director Patricia Berryhill. She helped start the Lower Ninth Ward Health Clinic, and she used to work at Charity Hospital. Patricia, let me start with you. There is this campaign going to reopen Charity Hospital, but there's the competing bid from the university to build a massive mega medical complex that will cost billions of dollars in the middle of New Orleans. Why is there a controversy? Why aren't they getting something moving, either one plan or the other?
Well, I think there's a lot of politics involved in that. And right now, we need something that's really going to open really fast, especially for our uninsured patients that we frequently served at the Lower Ninth Ward Health Clinic. I mean, they don't have the options like our insured clients to go to different hospitals to seek the care that they needed. Also, they don't have the resources to choose their own doctors. So we're really in a crisis down here with the closure of Charity Hospital.
So I assume that's why you started this Lower Ninth Ward Health Clinic. When did you start that, and what kind of volumes of patients are you seeing there?
Well, we were allowed to officially open in February of 2007. We attempted to open in 2006, about 6 months after Katrina, but we had a arrival of a surprise city health inspector. And being both nurses, Alice and myself, we weren't aware of some of the coding that was involved in starting, you know, in converting my home from a residential area to a commercial area. So really that made a stumbling block in us opening. So it took all about 10 minutes for me to sign the papers allowing my home to be converted from a residential to a commercial, facility. But, you know, not being involved in that, Alice and I both didn't know that. So through the help of an attorney that volunteered his services, we were made aware of certain city codes that we had to adhere to.
So, Karen DeSalvo, you are with the Tulane School of Medicine. How important was Charity Hospital to the New Orleans community?
Well, Charity Hospital, as you said, had been around for a couple of hundred years, and most doctors like myself had trained and worked there for generations. And as a hospital, it was important not just for training, but as a source of care for trauma care and other specialty care for patients. You know, what's important to remember, though, is that, as Patricia describes, there's been a lot of new healthcare opportunities that have come up in the city since Katrina in the vacuum that was left when Charity closed.
Well, Karen, let's talk about that for a moment. Yesterday we had a principal who was starting a charter school in the Ninth Ward say that one of the benefits of the storm was that it eradicated a horrible school system to be replaced by something innovative and new. Do you think there are similar opportunities in the healthcare sector in New Orleans? And is Charity Hospital, for all of its importance, maybe something better put in the past? Karen?
Well, I mean, Charity is always going to be needed in some fashion because of its training. And we know that since the big charity building closed that everybody thinks about, there's been a new facility that opened. But there's been now 25 organizations that have opened clinics across the city that are very innovative, just like the one Patricia's done. Tulane has a number of sites. And they're taking care of 160,000 low-income people in a very new neighborhood-based way.
And yet, Karen, we've had some pretty good studies from the Kaiser Family Foundation that have shown that the health situations of people, especially minorities, especially African Americans, especially the poor, have degraded seriously since Hurricane Katrina. So how are we going to address these health issues without,
you know,
Charity
Hospital? I think it's important always for people who are quite ill to have access to specialty care, hospital care, but the neighborhood-based clinics that are serving this large population of 160,000 folks. We're new. We've only been around for, 4 years. It's marked by high quality. There's a lot of them that have reached national recognition as patient-centered medical homes. And one thing that's got to be remembered epidemiologically is that a lot of these citizens of New Orleans had only access to emergency room care before the storm. Even though it was really good care at Charity, it was emergency room care.
Huh, that's interesting.
And so now we're discovering a lot of new diabetes and hypertension. So the numbers look worse for a little while until we can actually get it under control.
Patricia Berryhill, what lessons would you teach the rest of us in the United States about health care from your neighborhood-based perspective there in the Ninth Ward?
Well, from our neighborhood perspective, it is healthcare, community-based, is a very important part. Just like Dr. DeSalvo described, it stops a lot of unnecessary emergency room visits, the long waits. We also have a family atmosphere. You know, we, with the Lower Ninth Ward Health Clinic, Alice grew up in that area. I was a resident of the of the Lower Ninth Ward for 28 years. My kids grew up in that neighborhood. So the people of the community recognize us, they trust us, and we strive to give quality health care at that clinic. And, you know, we have discovered a lot of untreated diabetes, hypertension, you know, diseases that people just couldn't afford to go to a private physician, or like Dr. DeSalvo described, would really try to go to the emergency room, you know, for ailments that certainly could have been treated in a community-based clinic. So
yeah,
it's very important.
I'm sorry, Patricia. I just think that this is such an important part of the story, is that the opportunity in New Orleans with the destruction of our healthcare system, even the important elements, the opportunity we all took was to say, how can we create a system that's more accessible, higher quality, more patient-centered, and really more of the flavor of the neighborhoods of our city, and create a distributed network around town where people can have a door to go in that's friendlier, closer, knows them, and can identify disease before it gets too far along.
Well, if you find that out, you might want to tell President Obama.
No,
it's Karen
Great
DeSalvo.
Stuff.
She's the Vice Dean of Community Affairs and Health Policy at Tulane School of Medicine, and Patricia Berryhill, Clinical Director at the Lower Ninth Ward Health Clinic in New Orleans.
Well, what's the flavor in your neighborhood? Do you have neighborhood health care like the clinics in New Orleans there? If you have health care coverage, we've been asking you all morning, what do you like about it? Give us some positives. Surveys show most of you are actually happy with your coverage. What's great about yours? Tell us your story at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. You can get Andui right next to the clinic. That would be great.
I'm Celeste Headley.
I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
There are all kinds of visions for healthcare reform.
It'll be the first fun hospital in the world. We'll use humor to heal pain and suffering. Doctors and patients will work side by side as peers. There'll be no titles, no bosses. There'll be a community where joy is a way of life, where learning is the highest aim, where love is the ultimate goal.
So, hey, maybe we already have the perfect healthcare plan.
You know, there are polls out that show that 70 or 80% of Americans are satisfied with the health insurance that they currently have.
Loving our doctors and those $20 copays on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Tuesday, September 1st. I'm Celeste Headley in with John Hockenberry. Good morning, John.
Healing pain and suffering with humor. Now, that's a heroic enterprise.
You'd be good at that.
We should get into some of that, yeah, or I'll just make them sick. Good morning, Celeste. Coming up this hour, we're going to talk baseball, who's looking good in the pennant race. It's September, so we got to think about October. Sports junkies, that pre-workout aspirin could actually be giving you aches and pains. And Whitney Houston's heartwarming recovery story. She has a new album.
But first, Lori Roman is a nonprofit exec from Annapolis, Maryland. Lori, tell us, are you happy with your health care plan?
Well, I'm very happy with my health care plan, and we tested it to the max last year when my son was diagnosed. And I'll never forget the doctor's words when he first told me, with a massive, aggressive, invasive bone-eating tumor in his leg. And within 24 hours, we were able to go to the best orthopedic oncologist in the country. They acted with haste. They saved my son's leg and his life as we knew it. And so we tested it, and we're very happy with it.
I'm sure that you are.
Wow.
We're going to have more on that. Stay with us, Lori. But first, everything that you need to know this morning.
Well, in the headlines, Celeste, in Southern California, wildfires in and around Angeles National Forest doubled in size overnight, scorching another 50,000 acres. New rounds of evacuations have been ordered in L.A. County. The deadly blazes are just 15 miles north of downtown L.A. In the Pacific, meanwhile, Hurricane Ximena is roaring south of Cabo. It's on track to hit the Baja California Peninsula tonight. Emergency workers are evacuating thousands.
Back in the U.S., the president starts September with a briefing on the latest preparations for the expected spike in H1N1, that's swine flu. He'll hear from the CDC and Homeland Security. Massachusetts lawmakers might honor the late Ted Kennedy's request to fill his Senate seat quickly. They'll take up a bill next week that would let the governor appoint an interim successor until a special election is held in January.
World leaders are in Poland today commemorating the 70th anniversary of the start of World War II. Ceremonies began at dawn on the peninsula where a German battle battleship first fired shots on a Polish fort. Market moving today. Markets were down slightly yesterday, but the futures trading suggests a negative opening when Wall Street gets underway in about a half an hour. The Dow opens this hour at 94.96. The S&P will start trading at 10.21, and the NASDAQ begins at 20.09. In the middle of this healthcare debate, we've heard a lot of people who didn't like their health insurance, but who likes their health insurance? What works for you?
My name is Karen, and I'm calling from Weehawken, New Jersey. As of right now, I have excellent health insurance. My prescription plan is excellent. I rarely, if ever, have a copay when I go to the doctor's office. But I remember about 8 months ago, before I got this job, I had no health insurance. And maybe I'm just lucky.
Tell us the story of your healthcare happiness, like Karen did at 877-8-MY-TAKE or MyTake at thetakeaway.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway.
Good morning. I'm Celeste Headley. Coming up in just a few moments, we'll continue our series of healthcare roundtables. We're asking people today, we hear you like your healthcare. Do you? We've heard from a couple people already today.
Well, we heard that story of Lori there, her son diagnosed with aggressive bone cancer. She went to the insurance company. They get to go to the best doctor in the country. Treatment commences immediately. She says it saves her son's leg and his life. But, of course, Lori Roman is founder. She's an advocate, as well as being someone who has a personal story to tell. She's founder of Regular Folks United, which is an online forum for right-leaning bloggers. Lots of blog traffic on healthcare, of course.
Absolutely. So we're first going to turn for a little bit of clarity on this to Julie Mason. She's going to give us some background. Julie's the White House correspondent for the Washington Examiner. Julie, thanks for being with us.
Thanks, Celeste.
So this week, President Obama has a little bit of time in Washington before the legislators get back. What is he going to do with his time?
Well, he's laying low right now. A big question right here in Washington, especially at the White House, is what mood are these lawmakers going to be in when they come back? We've had some significant developments over the month of August, which seem to have really changed the dynamic in healthcare reform.
So do we have any ideas? Is he working behind the scenes?
Oh, sure. He's calling lawmakers. He's feeling them out. He's seeing what kind of mood they're in. You know, one of the things is there's been a drop in support for Obama in the polls. He's at a 50% approval rate in the latest Gallup poll. That's terrible for him. It makes you wonder, does he have political capital to get this done? Also, we've had these town hall theatricals that have made the White House very, very nervous. And also some dire...
You're not calling them in town meetings anymore. You call them theatricals. I like that.
They're theatricals.
Yeah.
They're
and these dire new deficit projections that have lawmakers very leery about taking on a big health care reform package. So the White House is making behind-the-scenes calls, feeling people out on how they feel about this stuff.
What is your feeling for how people are voting on this? I mean, we heard a lot about the fact that now that Ted Kennedy has passed away, he doesn't have the 60 votes that he needs, and he's kind of in doubt about his two independents there. What is your feelings for how close we are?
It really looks bad. I think they've really lost a lot of ground. I'm not sure how they make it up. I think we're going to be looking at a very scaled back package when lawmakers get back. I think the appetite for doing something major and something significant is gone.
Well, Julie, I talked to you yesterday about Max Baucus, who was at one point the Senate Democratic leader who was going to save the day on health care. You spoke with him over the weekend, and he rolled his eyes.
Yeah. Exactly. He's not happy with it anymore. And Chuck Grassley also. They're very much against the public option, and that might be off the table. These members of the Senate feel like there's no public will to include a public option, and that's something that liberal groups are really pushing hard for.
Okay, Julie Mason, thanks for joining us. She's the White House correspondent for the Washington Examiner.
Well, they're debating in Washington, but in the midst of all this debate about reforming our health care system, a new poll by the Rasmussen Report reveals that news that may seem surprising, about 80% of the people polled who have health insurance like the insurance cover that they have, they like it. Today we're joined by a number of listeners for a roundtable discussion on what health insurance is actually doing right. And we have a number of people. Lori Roman is a nonprofit executive from Annapolis, Maryland. She's also the founder of Regular Folks United, an online forum for right-leaning bloggers. And Evan Soule is a high school history and musical teacher from Baltimore. Evan and Lori, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Well, we heard how your program was tested, Lori. Let's get a sense from Evan Soule. What makes you so confident about your health care plan? Because you are one of the 70% of Americans who say they're happy with the coverage they receive.
As a civil servant, I get a really good package from the city of Baltimore, and I have three children. So I've never really had any issues I've ever had with health care with the kids, asthma. I've had knee surgery, whatever it might be, getting glasses. I've had no problems.
So,
I'm sorry, go ahead.
So does that make you feel good about the health care reform discussion in the sense that if yours isn't broken, there's no need to fix it, or are you threatened by this whole debate?
I think it's good. I think it's long overdue. I mean, I would rather have the government regulate. I'm with United Healthcare. I'd rather have them regulate these private companies, because if I can pay less than $100 for my prescription and my health, and I pay to Medicare, and if I'm paying state taxes, which also contribute if they allocate that, I'm paying for all this anyway. And the bottom line is, I think the federal government regulating these companies is better, because I found out last week off of an NPR debate that the president, the CEO of United Healthcare, makes $103,000 an hour. So, in my opinion, I don't think that, you know, there should be for-profit business when it comes to health or energy. I think that's, we're way too big a country, and it's written in the Constitution in the preamble. Federal government's responsible for the health and the welfare of the people. You can't have people sick.
But Evan, let me just turn it around a little bit. If that CEO for United Healthcare wasn't happy, maybe your coverage wouldn't be as secure as you're finding it with your three kids there.
And do you think that we should be paying people $20 million plus to be happy so our healthcare prices don't fluctuate?
No, you make a good point. Lori Roman, how about you? Are you worried about the pay of insurance executives, and does the current healthcare debate threaten your security about your plan, which, as you told us, was tested and was not found wanting?
Well, when my friends that live in Great Britain found out about my situation with my son, where his aggressive bone-eating tumor was, he was under treatment with one of the best orthopedic oncologists in the world within 24 hours, they just told me that that would never have happened in Great Britain. My son probably would have lost his leg. Had he had a cancerous tumor spreading, he could have possibly lost his life. So I worry about breaking what's not broken in order to fix something. So I think we need reform. I think there are ways to reform the system and to control costs that maximize individual liberty and limit government control over private health decisions. But I do know this. My son's leg probably would have not been saved in Great Britain, according to everything that I've seen from statistics and data and my friends' advice. And also, I have friends from Canada who said the same thing. My son's leg would not have been saved in Canada.
Well, let's talk about standard of care for a moment. Did your son receive what was described by your doctors as standard of care?
I don't know, but this is what I know. I had choice of doctor, I had choice of hospital, and I didn't have any government bureaucrats telling me that I couldn't go research and try to find the best care for my son. And I didn't have a long line that I had to wait in because of rationed care. And these are the things that I see when I see a large government interference in the marketplace. And so, yeah, I worry about not only, you know, I worry about a lot of kids like my son who wouldn't get as good a care if the government was involved in the bureaucracy.
Well, but Lori, Medicare is already involved in health care, and it doesn't affect your security or your sense of freedom of choice, right?
Well, I have to tell you, last year we really did test the system, because while my son was undergoing treatment with a private health insurance, my father was undergoing treatment through Medicare. And my father died because of Medicare bureaucracy. They sent him home from the hospital because his fever was 0.1 degrees under the Medicare guideline for hospitalization. The doctor told me his hands were tied. He had to pull an IV antibiotic out of my elderly father, even though he still had an infection. My father died within 3 weeks from that infection.
Well, that's a broad range of experiences there. Lori, let me just get Evan Soule's response to that. Lori is really describing a situation where in the private sector, she has security, but if you slip over into the public sector, she's worried about rationing. What are you worried about, Evan?
Well, no disrespect to Lori, but I find that shocking. Most of the horror stories you hear about people with private health care insurance, they're covered, then they're not covered. All kinds of the bureaucracy with the private health care insurance, and try to fight an insurance company over any issue. Just, you know, I think you could already know the difficulty you're going to have. They're private. They're for profit. They're the ones that are making decisions that are costing people's lives. And the government is completely different. It's funny that most of our health care is in the hands of people making profit, who are making these types of mistakes all the time.
All right, well, this is a fascinating debate. We're down to the last minute. Lori, let me just ask you a question. Have you ever had excessive paperwork or frustrations dealing with your own private insurer?
No, I haven't. But the nice thing about a private insurer is you can shop around and find one that has better customer service. With my father's Medicare, we were stuck. And even though he had private insurance, the Medicare rules trumped the private insurance. Mm. So we were locked in, and truly my father suffered and died because of a Medicare bureaucracy.
Okay, Lori, how much is your premium for your private insurer? Do you know?
I actually have it completely paid for by
my employer. Okay, Lori Roman is a nonprofit executive from Annapolis, Maryland. Evan Soule, how much do you pay for your premium?
$30 a month.
$30 a month. High school history and music teacher from Baltimore. He gets his insurance coverage through the city of Baltimore. Thank you, Evan. And Lori, we should point out that Lori Roman is an advocate opposed to the current health care debate, at least the Democratic position. She's founder of Regular Folks United, an online forum for right-leaning bloggers. And the debate today is, if you're happy, why? Those are two different slices of the people happy with their
coverage. That's the question, because surveys say that for those who do have health insurance, they're happy with the insurance that they have. So if that is you, give us a call at 8778-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org.
Of course, if you're not happy, you can call. There's a lot of our listeners that are
all right,
happy.
Okay.
They love to complain. 8778-MY-TAKE. They're perfectly happy to call.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
869-8253.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. I'm Celeste Headley. We'll have all your sports news coming up in about 4 minutes. But in the meantime, John, if you've talked to runners, a lot of them take a painkiller like an aspirin before they run.
Or Vicodin.
That's right. Not so sure about that one.
Probably
but not. They say it keeps down the aches and the pains. Turns out it's not such a good idea. So joining us is Gretchen Reynolds. She's on the line from Santa Fe, New Mexico, where she's probably feeling no pain. She writes the weekly phys ed column for our partner, the New York Times website. So Gretchen, we've been hearing for years you should take an ibuprofen, pop one before you go for a run, because it'll make you feel better when you finish. Turns out that's not true.
No, it's not true. And in fact, it probably does exactly the reverse. There was a study that came out earlier this month of what people were taking at the Ironman in Brazil, and about 60% of them were popping ibuprofen either right before or frequently during the race because they thought that it would both help them get through the pain of the race, and it does hurt, and even more that it would keep them from being sore afterwards. And it turns out it does neither of those. It doesn't make you feel any better during the race. It doesn't make you any less sore after the race. And it actually slows the healing of muscles. So you probably wind up a lot more sore than you would be.
Well, but how does that work? Because ibuprofen, it's supposed to reduce inflammation, right? It's supposed to kill pain. So why is it not doing that when you go for a run?
Well, it does not seem to be working against the pain, the discomfort, really, that is part of a hard workout. And that's partly because no one knows exactly what's causing the discomfort of a hard workout.
Well,
but it's not just inflammation.
Being in the Ironman is causing the discomfort.
Yes, that seems to be absolutely clear. It is going to be uncomfortable. And they've done studies in which they asked people during some of these long, hard events, how do you feel? They would ask them at water stops. And the people who were taking ibuprofen, and often quite a bit of ibuprofen, did not feel any better than the people who were not taking ibuprofen. Neither one of them felt great, but they did not feel any better.
So do we know? Do we know what people should be doing? I mean, is there a way that people can kind of cut down on the aches and pains of running a lot?
No. What you need to do is actually listen to your body probably a little better. What happens if you take things like some of these painkillers is you can actually run through the beginnings of slight injuries and make them worse. And even more, it actually inhibits the healing of tissue. It inhibits prostaglandins. That's what it is supposed to do. But prostaglandins are very important for the healing of small muscle tears, which you get when you do a lot of working out. So if you're taking a lot of ibuprofen, you are actually making yourself overall probably feel worse,
okay,
and not healing as well.
Okay, great Gretchen takeaway. Reynolds, thanks. She writes a weekly column for the New York Times. She also covers fitness for Women's Health and O, the Oprah magazine. You can check out Gretchen's Phys Ed column tomorrow on our partner, the New York Times website.
And if you are in pain and running an Ironman, stopping running the Ironman will actually make you feel better.
I'm detecting a bias here.
Dr. Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen, who's very buff and in the studio today, Takeaway sports contributor, joins us because it is September 1st. That means 30 days between now and October baseball. Let's take a look at the playoff runs. The Yankees, of course, are way out in front in the AL East. I'm always talking about that. But this little team out in Detroit, the Tiggers, seems to be doing pretty well.
The closest race in the AL right now is between the Detroit Tigers, the Minnesota Twins, and the Chicago White Sox. If you had talked to me about a week ago, I would have said that it's basically between the Detroit Tigers and the Chicago White Sox.
But the Yankees swept them over the weekend.
Exactly. So fast forward to right now, it's all about the Detroit Tigers. So let's talk about them a little bit.
Celeste is on her feet right now. Yeah.
This is a big day for Michigan. The guy I really like is a guy named Curtis Granderson. Curtis Granderson is an extremely athletic, speedy wide receiver.
And Granderson goes after the first pitch, and he drives it deep into the night and makes it a 3-2 ball game.
So a real outfielder who's a slugger.
He's definitely a slugger. He actually hasn't been so hot at the plate right now, but he's definitely in contention for a Golden Glove. When he was with your Yankees, he scorched them last year in old Yankee Stadium. Granderson's a great player, and he's poised to do really well because Leland, the manager of the Tigers, is an excellent playoff manager, and he's going to get his team prepared. The other thing that's great about this squad right now, Cabrera, who's we're a little skeptical about him at first, but he's come through as a great first baseman, and his bat has been doing the work for itself. And then there's also the pitching staff.
They've got a great pitching
staff.
They have a great starting rotation. Justin Verlander has been lights out.
He's been amazing.
Yes, he's been really ridiculous. And then, of course, people get a little nervous about Rodney. But he's shaking.
I'm
sometimes
a little nervous.
Tigers have been heartbreakers, even though they've been really a solid team in the last 10 years. Let's move on to the National League Central.
Yes.
Who's back?
Well, I mean, the St. Louis Cardinals. They're what's it? They have a huge lead over the Cubs. And, you know, in the beginning of the season, it felt like the Cubs were going to really do something, but it didn't make it happen. Enter the return of John Smoltz. And why? Because of the Dave Duncan, the pitching coach of St. Louis Cardinals. He turns struggling pitchers into good pitchers again. And so that's going to be...
Smoltz was jettisoned by the Red Sox.
Correct.
And picked up by the Cards
Correct.
In the middle of the season. It looks like he might be some October baseball
man. He's going to be very ready for October. And they, of course, have Albert Pujols, who might win the batting championship.
Right. Now, last thing. People are saying this year, though, is California's year in the playoffs. How do the California teams look?
Well, you have the Dodgers and you have the Giants. It's going to be... right now, it's a three-way race right now between the Dodgers, the Giants, and the Rockies. That is the most exciting race in baseball right now. And I want to talk a little bit more about that this week. But just real quick, going back to Michigan, in terms of the Michigan sports scene, the Michigan football team, there's been allegations. And actually, I write about that on the
University of Michigan.
Oh, yeah. Right, the University of Michigan. And I write about that on the blog. So if you're interested in that story, you can read about that.
All right, but very, very quickly, before we go to headlines, we've got the AL East Yankees are in. You think Detroit or the Twins, maybe? Maybe the White Sox?
I'm definitely going with Detroit.
Rockies, Giants, and Dodgers?
That is a race that, the Dodgers might have to check their backs.
And the Cardinals in the NL Central.
Without a doubt.
All right, thanks so much, Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen, Takeaway Sports contributor, the playoff race in baseball. And he's such a charmer for going back to Michigan for you, I thought. Don't you think?
I'm not sure how to react to that.
Ibrahim's a charmer. Here's some of the top headlines we're looking at.
California wildfires continue to rage in the foothills of Los Angeles. The blaze has destroyed over 50 homes and threatens thousands more in the L.A. County area. U.N. Secretary General Ban Ki-moon is visiting the Arctic Circle in Norway. He hopes to draw attention to the need for urgent action at climate change talks in December.
The European Union has banned certain incandescent light bulbs in an effort to encourage more people to use energy-efficient bulbs. And this could
Edison was would be shocked. It's good.
Yeah, Sylvania. Who knows?
Absolutely.
Who knows? But those are some of the top stories we're watching today.
So eight of the country's largest banks are paying us back with interest.
Did you get your check yet?
Does that mean we're in the money? Coming up, the New York Times' Louise Story joins us in a few minutes.
You're listening to The Takeaway.
Good morning, I'm Celeste Headley. So yesterday, our partners over at the New York Times reported that profits collected from eight of the largest banks that received a government bailout have repaid everything they owed to the government.
You were going crazy over this yesterday.
This is pretty big thing because the government then collected $4 billion in profits that they're getting their piece of the bank share. Now, granted, $4 billion is a small portion of the $700 billion that we paid. But Louise Story, the Wall Street and Finance reporter for the New York Times, is here. Louise, still, I mean, it's a small portion, but isn't it good news?
Yeah, but let's digest this, okay? The banks who were first to repay were the healthiest, right? So, of course, we made a profit. It's good we made a profit. If we didn't make a profit, everyone would be freaking out that we didn't make a profit. So there is a selection bias here in terms of who repaid and the ability they had to pay back the money on good terms to the U.S. government. In fact, in conversations I had with different bankers who repaid early, some of them, like at places like Goldman, were telling me, we want to make sure on these warrants we pay a high price so no one's saying that we didn't pay enough.
So they're kind of inoculating themselves from bad stories.
Absolutely.
So Goldman, great investment, right? Citibank?
Well, we don't know yet. They haven't paid back the money, and that's a big question.
So you're saying that a lot of this is kind of PR on the part of the banks? They're trying to clean up their image?
To a certain perspective, on the part of the banks as well as the part of the Treasury Department, everyone wants to show some progress in the banking system. We saw a lot of spin around this in the spring and early summer with the banks saying, we're going to pay back. And you know, now the government's happy to take a few wins.
So quickly, who should we be worried about? If it's not these eight healthiest banks, who are we kind of keeping our eye on?
So there are a lot of other programs. You know, there's hundreds of banks that got this money from the government. But then also we got to keep in mind that there's hundreds of billions of dollars that have gone out through programs through the Federal Reserve. The FDIC has a ton of programs where they've been backing debt, sharing losses on pools of toxic assets of failed banks. And so all of this could add up to, quite a lot of losses. And hopefully it won't. You know, the Treasury Department, they actually had someone whose title was Chief Investment Officer. So they're keeping an eye on it, but we won't know for a while.
So the jury is out.
The jury is out.
She's the Wall Street and Finance Reporter for the New York Times. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
$4 billion on the plus column. We'll note that down.
$696
along with the
other numbers. On the negative.
Exactly. There you go. A quick update now on the election in Afghanistan. Obama, the president yesterday, or actually the president earlier in the month of August, had this to say about the people who voted in the Afghan election.
We knew that the Taliban would try to derail this election. Yet even in the face of this brutality, millions of Afghans exercised the right to choose their leaders and determine their own destiny.
But if the election in Afghanistan is derailed, it may be because of the behavior of the candidates themselves. Brian Katulis is a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress. He was an election observer in Afghanistan, and we asked him onto the program to comment on the growing number of allegations of fraud in the election that all have to be checked before this election can be certified. The Obama administration has hoped it would be certified by mid-September. That looks pretty doubtful. Brian, first of all, what is the nature of the allegations? And can we say that this election is even salvageable, given that there are hundreds of allegations of corruption in the voting?
Well, there's a wide range of allegations, including ballot box stuffing to problems with voter ID cards, with women in particular. We don't know yet the magnitude or how large those alleged vote fraud instances are, but it looks pretty serious. We're up in the hundreds in terms of close to 700-800 high priority complaints that the Electoral Commission is looking at, the Complaints Commission. And, you know, I think, and I stated this before, that it was way too early the day of the election or the day after the election for the president or anyone else to call this process a success, because it still is a process. I think of it as a baseball game. We're still in the seventh inning of a process that's still unfolding, because it takes much longer in a country like Afghanistan just to simply tabulate the votes.
Well, and the question is really, are there steroids in the ballot box? You know, if you're going to use the baseball analogy there, let's look at the disturbing story on Sunday, when all of a sudden the allegations that the commission that you mentioned has to look into doubled from 270 allegations to over 500 allegations. It seems like there's two clocks ticking here. One is to get a new government in place for just the stability of the country, but there's also the sense of public outrage in Afghanistan. At a certain point, people are just going to give up on this process altogether. How much time does the Electoral Commission have, do you think?
I actually, I think it probably has a few weeks past the September 17th target date that they set for itself, but not much longer than that. And right now, I think there's been a relative period of quiet inside of Afghanistan. I highlight relative. It's the holy month of Ramadan. Violence has been down somewhat. I worry, and I stated this even before the elections, about the prospect for post-election violence. It's not a bold prediction. There was a lot of violence on election day. There were about 300 to 400 attacks around the country. But I don't think they can delay too long, because if it looks like this is running for a second round.
And it does at this point, right?
Yeah, it does so far. I mean, we're not certain yet. We only have got about 50% of the results in. But it will go to a second round with the two top vote getters if none of them get more than 50%. If that happens, they would try to have to hold this election before the winter comes, because in Afghanistan, because of the snows and the climate and the environment, it's very, very difficult to hold an election, I think, past late October.
Well, there's another clock, a weather clock ticking there in Afghanistan. Brian Katulis is a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress, taking a look at the election just passed in Afghanistan and looking forward to the possibility of a runoff between Hamid Karzai, the incumbent, and Abdullah, top opposition vote getter in the Afghan election. Brian, thanks so much for being with us. And now let's take a look at some other headlines in
the
news.
Well, our partner, the New York Times, is reporting about a big business deal in the online world. eBay is set to announce the sale of its popular online calling division, Skype. The Times reports a group of private investors is buying it. Vermont is now the fifth state with legal same-sex marriage. The law kicked in just after midnight there. Some couples said vows in the early morning hours.
Pakistan says it has killed or captured dozens of militants in the region bordering Afghanistan. Two militant commanders are among the dead. And a new government study is sounding the alarm about heavy drinkers on the road. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention says 1 in 10 binge drinkers got behind the wheel the last time they drank heavily. The CDC says binge drinking is a primary factor in more than 11,000 car crash fatalities every year. It wants tougher enforcement of laws requiring bartenders to cut off service to intoxicated customers. Those are some of the top stories we're watching today.
And a reminder, we're asking everyone all day today, in the middle of this healthcare debate, if you have healthcare insurance, do you like it?
10 years ago, I had breast cancer and needed a mastectomy. Since then, I've had a series of illnesses with ongoing visits to doctors almost weekly. I can choose any doctor and any hospital here in Manhattan where I live. I often say without it, I'd be dead.
We want to hear your story. What does your insurance do for you? Tell us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or send us an email at mytake@thetakeaway.org. Coming up, how is Whitney going to know that you love her, John? How will she know?
She won't care.
She's looking to make a comeback, Whitney Houston. We'll get a look at her next album, her new album, in just a few minutes.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry.
And I'm Celeste Headley. Wildfires north of Los Angeles continue to burn today. In fact, firefighters say they could burn for the next few weeks. Over 50 houses have been destroyed. Many thousands are in danger. We're going to check in with the latest on those fires with Patricia Nazario. She's a reporter for KPCC, Southern California Public Radio. Patricia, you're at the Fire Command Center in the Hamsin Dan Recreation Area. What does it look like there?
Well, from here, I see lots ash falling. It's a bit of an overcast sky. I mean, it would look like a hazy Southern California afternoon if you didn't know that a wildfire was raging 5 miles or 7 miles from here.
It's supposed to rain today? I mean, is there any hope that the rain is going to help them with their firefighting efforts?
Absolutely. I was just in the morning briefing, the 6 o'clock briefing that they have before they send out the morning crews, and that's the one thing that they were talking about. First, and secondly, that this a big change today. They said it's sort of like movie Groundhog's Day, where it's the same thing day after day, extreme conditions, and no way to get the upper hand on this fire, and they just may get
that break today with the weather.
They also gave you some updates on the size of the fire and the height of the flames. What did they say about how this fire is looking?
Well, the fire increased. Yesterday it was at about 85,000 acres. This morning it's 122,000 acres. Continues to be 5% contained. Firefighters say they made some progress last night, about 30%, but the fire is raging so much it just continues to stay in that 5% contained category. We're talking about 4,200 residents evacuated in the foothill areas. Communities here, Sunland, Tahunga, La Cañada is another one, Altadena, which is just above Pasadena. And then to the extreme other side of the fire is this little rural community called Acton, where lots of people have horses and dog kennels and stuff like that. And that was evacuated a couple days ago.
We've also heard that despite desperate pleas from the governor and fire officials, that there are some people who are not heeding the call for evacuation. They've had to mount some rescue efforts.
That was yesterday, and it's, you know, something that firefighters here and these fire officials are taking very seriously, because they say these are efforts, these are resources that need to be going to fight the fire, not getting distracted to rescue people who ignored mandatory evacuation orders. Yesterday, there was a group of five, maybe six people who had got an evacuation order yesterday morning at about 7:30 and ignored it. By 12:30 or so, they were calling for help. And so the Los Angeles County Sheriff's Department set up a couple of ground units and a helicopter, and then the firefighters them to stand back because the flames were just too erratic. It was too crazy. So they had to just wait it out. And then they got a call back from the people up in this little community called Gold Creek, and they said, well, never mind, we'll ride it out. We have transportation. And from what we understand this morning, they got themselves out of there.
Patricia, you said yesterday that they were hoping to have it at least to a safe level of containment by Friday. Has that changed?
Well, you know, they're projecting now it could be 9 days away before they get this contained. A lot has to do with the weather. They're throwing the resources at it. Aerosol, you know, they have the fire personnel. We're talking about 200 firefighters, 500, I think it's up to now. And if they get the break in weather, then they can bring this under control. If not, it's rage on for another 9 days.
Okay, Patricia Nazario is a reporter for KPCC, Southern California Public Radio. Stay safe, and thanks so much.
All right.
You're listening to The Takeaway from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
I'm Celeste Headley with John Hockenberry. Coming up, how does a victim like J.C. Dugard, if you're kidnapped for 18 years, how do you recover from that? We'll talk about it in a few minutes. And in the middle of this healthcare debate, we've heard a lot from people who don't like their health insurance or don't have it. But are you happy with your coverage?
This is Judy McLam. I'm from North Carolina. I'm self-employed. I have Blue Cross Blue Shield, and I'm paying $1,127 a month for just my husband and I. We have good coverage, but we're working all the time to pay for the insurance and the taxes.
We want to hear your story and what your insurance does for you. Tell us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or send us an email at mytake@thetakeaway.org. In the news, Hurricane Ximena is heading toward Mexico's Baja Peninsula. The storm is just short of a Category 5 and has prompted evacuations in that area. And President Obama is starting the month with a briefing on the latest efforts to prepare for H1N1 virus, also known as swine flu. Later today, the president will host a dinner at the White House to celebrate the Muslim holy month of Ramadan.
Dinner will be after sundown, you can be sure of that. Staying in Washington, the president announced he is reducing federal pay increases for next year. Increases will be 2% instead of 2.4%. And tennis player Venus Williams overcame setbacks and emerged victorious in her first round match at the U.S. Open. Those are some of the top stories that we're watching today.
So it's been almost a week since J.C. Dugard escaped 18 years of imprisonment and sexual assault. Now that she and her daughters are free, how do they start recovering from something like that? Science Times reporter Benedict Carey joins us this morning. He wrote a front page article in today's New York Times that talks about how former captives can start recovering from their ordeals, both emotionally and mentally. So how do they do that? What steps do they take?
Well, there's therapy they can get. I mean, we know it's possible because, millions of people have undergone sort of horrible things, war crimes and prison camps and so on, and built full lives afterwards. But there is a specific therapy for this if she chooses to try it. And it works on things, certain, you know, thoughts and beliefs that are distorted that may have developed during the ordeal and kind of unwanted emotions, and tries to help the person sort of tell the story and file it away as a chapter of their lives instead of the defining story of their lives.
So you, in your article, make the distinction between cognitive behavioral therapy and, say, psychotherapy. In other words, you're saying it's probably not good for her to relive what she went through for the past years, but behavioral therapy focuses on changing your thought patterns to replace sort of negative, non-positive thoughts with good, strong, positive thoughts.
Sort of. I mean, some people do apparently benefit from reliving it and sort of blunting the emotion that comes with re-experiencing it, but not everybody does. But yeah, cognitive therapy deals with sort of examining and diffusing kind of distorted beliefs like, oh, it was my fault, or I can never trust anyone again.
You know, Ben, this reminds me a little bit of that creepy Jodie Foster movie Nell, where she's like raised in an environment where her entire reality is distorted. I mean, I'm just wondering, being underneath the sort of umbrella of these people, your sense of the outside world would be so distorted. How do you regain that?
Well, I think it starts with reconnecting with, in her case, her first family, and beginning to trust other people and finding a kind of a new reality, a new social bond through them. People who have been in captivity often are very ambivalent about their captors. You know, they've been shown a cruel side, but also a kind side. And they have to acknowledge that often, that it's a mixed person, even though it looks like a monster from the outside to us. And they're also very ambivalent about their own actions when they're in captivity. I mean, you know, the one question that hangs over these cases is, why didn't you do anything? Why didn't you run? Why didn't you fight? And the fact is, in often cases, they don't, for survival reasons. And they have to understand, I think, why they did those things, and not judge themselves too harshly in retrospect, but to appreciate that at the time, you know, they had very good reasons for making those decisions.
So, Benedict Carey, your science reporter for our partner, the New York Times, this whole thing is complicated by the fact that J.C. Dugard is now the subject of intense media scrutiny, and that'll probably continue for a little while. I mean, she's definitely, she in the spotlight, her stepdad was on Larry King, so her any recovery plans she has are going to be complicated by being so much attention paid to her.
Well, she's stuck the press pretty well so far. The kids are out of sight. She's been spending time, apparently, with her mom. And the stepdad appears to be acting as kind of a spokesperson, and maybe this will, the press coverage will kind of clear, and she'll be allowed to have some privacy and make some decisions with, you know, on her own or with her parents or her mom. I mean, Elizabeth Smart did that, it appears, and it seems to have worked fairly well for them. So, you know, so far so good. I mean, I think a lot of therapists I talked to said that they're impressed that she's kept herself sort of close to family and hasn't made a spectacle of it.
Well, let's hope that continues to go very well.
Given interviews or...
Benedict Carey is a science reporter for our partner, the New York Times. He wrote a front page article in the Today's paper.
What do you say we go out on one more heartwarming recovery story? Whitney Houston, looking for a comeback. Title track and single on Whitney Houston's new album, I Look to You. It was released yesterday. Maura Johnston is the editor of the music blog Idolator. We're also going to talk about Chris Brown here, who's trying to launch his own kind of redemptive comeback. But first of all, Maura, Whitney has a new album. Is it any good?
It's pretty okay. It's got, you know, it has a really nice selection of big hit songwriters, like Alicia Keys has a song on it, R. Kelly, and then they brought out, you know, Diane Warren and David Foster, the sort of old school big ballad guys. But I mean, for what it is, you know, it's different. It's definitely not, she's not hitting the big notes that she did in that cover of I Will Always Love You.
Well, she's certainly aged.
Yes, she has.
Is she capable of functioning in public, do you think?
I think, you know, she was brought out to a couple of listening events, and like she apparently was really great at them, and
she was brought out
by Clive Davis, her sort of mentor. Right.
There's a strong consensus that she is a property among the people in the music business who really want this album to succeed.
Definitely. I mean, they put it, you know, usually new records come out on Tuesdays. Actually, yesterday the record came out because August 31st was the deadline for the 2010 Grammys. So this is definitely being positioned to be, you know, a sort of big award winner.
And Whitney Houston, for all of her foibles and her lunacy in public, I mean, is basically the story of overcoming obstacles.
Definitely.
And, you know, her own demons and personal demons. So that's a pretty classic story. This one, maybe not so classic.
When you hear about all the things that the police and the reports say you did, how do you react to that?
I'll just look at it like, wow, like, I'm in shock because, first of all, that's not who I am as a person, and that's not who I pride myself on being. So I just, when I look at, like, the police reports or I hear about the police reports, I don't know what to think. I just don't know what to think. It's just like, wow.
You remember doing it?
No.
Don't remember doing it?
I don't, it's like, it's crazy to me. Like, I'm like, wow.
Well, whoever beat up Rihanna, he looked an awful lot like Chris Brown. There's Chris Brown on the Larry King show. He looking for a comeback himself. Did he do himself any favors on the Larry King show?
Well, you know, after that segment came out, actually, he released a statement saying that, you know, if you watch the full show, which is airing tomorrow night on CNN, you can see that he actually was asked multiple times that, you know, whether or not he remembered it. And he kept saying he didn't want to talk about it. He didn't want to talk about it. So I don't know. I mean, obviously, with that segment, you know, it was very explosive and, like, it definitely had a big reaction throughout, you know, the internet and everything.
And he's been sentenced to community service for a long, long period of time.
Yeah, yeah. And he can't contact Rihanna and, you know, other things. And he says that he's still in love with her, too, so.
But very, very quickly, I mean, this seems to me, to use an overused phrase, like a real teachable moment for young kids who are struggling with dating and violence, and it seems like these celebrities are going to botch it completely.
I know. You know, the problem is, too, I think the media will just botch it, too, because they're so interested in the sensationalism that they're just not going to sort of figure out the good that can come from this. I mean, it's a horrible situation, but, you know, all of the sort of frenzy and froth isn't really helping.
Well, you could say Whitney and Bobby were a teachable moment about drugs, and that was a botched opportunity also.
Well, thank you, Maura Johnston, for all the frenzy and froth. She's the editor of the music blog Idolator. And you may or may not love Whitney Houston. A lot of opinions about that. But for those of you who have health coverage, surveys show you mostly love it. Why is the question?
My name is Michael. Generally, we're very happy with our current plan through our employer. However, there are idiosyncrasies. For example, our daughter recently had knee surgery. She went back to college in another state and was told by the insurance company that she could not have physical therapy in that state because it was out of the service area. That, I think, is one of the issues that needs to be dealt with.
That's great stuff. And here's what another one of you said.
I'm Lil in Chapin, South Carolina. I'm satisfied with my health care plan, but I'm one of the people that would be in what's known as the dreaded public option. I have Medicare coverage, and I have a Medicare supplement plan provided.
If you're happy with your health care and you know it, share it with us at thetakeaway.org, 877-8-MY-TAKE, or go to our website. While you're at it, you can catch up on anything you missed. Catch our podcast to go at thetakeaway.org. I'm John Huckenberry.
I'm Celeste Headley. This is The Takeaway.
You know, you can catch the show live Monday through Friday. Thanks for listening. If you have any feedback or think there's any stories we should be covering on The Takeaway, contact us at 1-877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. See ya.